Well, welcome back to HealthLink On Air, produced each week by Upstate Medical University, making the academic difference in healthcare in the Central New York community. And this is your host, Tricia Torrey, Every Patient's Advocate. We're joined this morning by Dr. Dominic Carone, Clinical Assistant Professor and the Coordinator for Upstate's Neuropsychological Assessment Program in Upstate's Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation. Good morning, Dr. Carone. That's quite a mouthful.
Yes, it is. Thank you very much.
And we're glad to have you here. I want to start with some basics because neuropsychology is, that's a great big word. Can you tell us what it means?
It is a big word. It sometimes scares people away, but what it really means, it's the study of the relationship between brain functioning and how someone thinks, feels, and behaves.
Okay, well, when I think of it, and I had to read about it to really kind of get the gist of it, it seems to me that we have brain imaging, and we've talked before with doctors about the imaging they do, or even, you know, like you take an X-ray of a bone or a CAT scan of a bone. You're looking at a whole different part of the brain. We can take a picture of it, but what you do is the other side of it.
Right. We're looking really at how the brain actually functions. And a standard brain CT or brain MRI scan is going to tell you about the structure of the brain, but our testing will tell you about how the brain is functioning.
So, like the thinking parts of it.
Yes, yes. The testing mostly focuses on the thinking part of the brain. So we do assess areas such as attention, concentration, memory, higher level thinking such as abstract thinking, planning, organization, multitasking. We look at learning and memory. We look at expressive and receptive language skills. We look at visual spatial functioning. We look at some other areas as well, such as motor functioning and sensory functioning, because those are also mediated by brain functions. And we also look at emotions and personality as well.
Now I feel like I'm back in school.
Okay.
Like you've just explained to me all the things I think I was supposed to learn in school.
Right.
So is that what you're testing, is what I learned in school?
No, it's not exactly like a school test. There are some times where we do give an academic achievement test, which would be a test of reading or a test of spelling or a test of math in certain cases. But many of these types of tests are not actually a situation in which someone would come in and sit down at a table and take a pencil and paper and complete a form for 3 hours or 4 hours. It's actually a very interactive process in which the examiner is directly working with the patient and doing various tasks. For example, learning a list of words, being exposed to visual spatial material over consecutive trials and seeing how much of the information the person learns and then how much the person remembers after 20 or 25 minutes or so. Right. So it's very different from actually, you know, sitting in a classroom and completing a test.
So it's not like I'm taking a history test and I had to memorize lots of dates. This is more about how I remember things over a period of time that aren't necessarily history or math. It's more about how my brain perhaps retains the information.
That would be true for the memory types of tests. This is not a type of evaluation where you actually study for or go to Barnes & Noble and buy a book to prepare for. That's not what it's like. So for the memory tests, that is true. So we're looking, for example, at how someone acquires information over repeated trials, how well the person is able to recall that information without cues, how well the person is able to recognize that information with cues. We do that in both the verbal and the visual spatial domain, but that's just one specific part of the testing. That's the learning and memory part. But like I mentioned earlier, there's many other different types of tests that we look at because there's different areas of the brain mediate different functions. So we're looking at a whole array of cognitive functioning.
Well, actually, what we need to step back to is to say that the reason this is being done is for medical and health purposes, not for school learning purposes. And so that would explain part of the reasons why these tests are a little bit different, because you actually are looking at what perhaps diagnosing and treating certain kinds of conditions and diseases.
That is correct. We are looking in certain cases we know neurologically what is wrong with the person. So for example, we might know that the person suffered a significant traumatic brain injury. So that's not in dispute at all. What we are looking for in that case is what has been the effect of the traumatic brain injury on that person's cognitive functioning and their emotional functioning. Now, there are cases in which the information is actually directly related to school, because let's say that person with the traumatic brain injury wants to go back to school. And let's further say that the testing shows that that person had frontal lobe damage and the person was unable to recall information from memory without cues, but the person was able to access the information with cueing. That would give us some information that in a school setting, that person would probably need to have tests modified to a multiple choice format so that they're not unfairly penalized for a neurological condition that they have no control over.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Well, what are some of the diseases and conditions besides traumatic brain injury that you actually deal with?
We mostly see traumatic brain injury, but we see many other conditions. We also see stroke cases. We see cases of patients with brain tumors. We see cases of patients with movement disorders that affect people neurologically, such as Parkinson's disease. We see patients with developmental disorders, both adults and children. Cerebral palsy would be one example. So there are many different conditions that we see. I never know what I'm going to see on any given week. That's just the fun part of the job.
That's interesting. And actually, that answers my next question. I wanted to know whether your patients are all mostly older.
On average, yes, but 30% of my practice is children. So I do see children down to age 5. And there are two other neuropsychologists that we have in the PM&R department. One is joining us in September, who do see adolescents down to age 16. But I see them down to age 5.
Very good. Yes. So you really do cover that whole gamut of ages.
Yes, because children and adults can suffer traumatic brain injuries. Many people don't realize that children can also suffer strokes. So there are a fair number of childhood stroke cases that I see. And as I mentioned, you know, children have developmental disorders that need to be addressed, and those sometimes carry on into adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes a person needs an evaluation in adulthood to find out if they are able to do any further schooling or pursue a particular occupation that they might want to.
Oh, that's great. That's fascinating. Well, let's take a representative patient. You know, we know one thing, for instance, is that dementia and Alzheimer's is increasing in numbers as the population ages.
Right.
And you can actually do some assessments of dementia to determine whether or not it's Alzheimer's disease or how to work with a patient. So take me through that. A patient comes to you, and what happens?
Right. Well, and that's one of the groups I did leave out on the list of patients that we do see. Dementia evaluations are one of the things that we do as well. So when a patient comes to the office, what we do is we go through an informed consent procedure with them to let them know what it actually is that is going to happen during the evaluation. And really, it's broken down into two main parts. The first part is a detailed clinical interview, which usually lasts for several hours, in which we're going over with the patient, and hopefully a family member is there as well, or someone who knows the person closely, so we could go over all the relevant information and clinical history to truly understand the case. And this includes when the particular problem started up until the present time. We go over any previous medical history. We go over any family medical history. We also go over psychiatric history. We go over social history as well. And by social history, I mean how far did the person go in school, what's their occupational level like in the past. And then we usually on a separate day bring the person back for the testing part. And the testing part takes about several hours. And what we're doing there is assessing all the different domains that I mentioned to you earlier. And the job of the neuropsychologist is really to combine the information that's gathered from multiple sources of information into a coherent, conceptualized understanding of the patient that can hopefully guide treatment. So we're putting together the information from the clinical interview. We're putting that together with the information that we get from the testing, from our knowledge and training of brain behavior relationships, from our review of the medical records that are available. And we're trying to see if things all come together to make sense, if there's certain patterns that emerge that might suggest, for example, that the older individual who comes into my office has Alzheimer's disease. Mm-hmm. Alzheimer's disease can only be diagnosed if you have a neuropsychologist doing the evaluation.
What we've thought until now is that the only way it could be diagnosed was when somebody died and they did an autopsy.
Well, right. So when I say that, I'm referring to when the person is alive. If the person is deceased, yes, you can confirm it on autopsy. But while the person is alive.
But I think it's great that there's a way now to diagnose it without that.
Absolutely. But it also helps with differential diagnosis because sometimes a provider or a family member might not be sure if the person's reported memory problems are because they have a neurological condition such as Alzheimer's disease, or if it's because the person is significantly depressed. Depression is very common in old age.
Sure.
Or they might be concerned, is this just normal forgetting?
Mm-hmm.
Because you do start to forget more as you get older.
Yes, we do.
and the other thing is there are other factors that could account for a dementing condition. Sometimes people equate dementia with Alzheimer's disease, but there are many different types of dementia.
Right. Well, we see them as symptoms as coming across oftentimes very much the same way, but you are then neurologically seeing something different. Do you, you said you look at the medical records too. Can you align? Are there ways to align what you find in the neuropsychological testing with, say, say, some of the imaging? Can you identify places in an image?
Yes, that's actually a very important part of what we do, is try to correlate the neuropsychological test results to what we see on imaging. So, for example, in Alzheimer's disease, it's known that the temporal lobes are typically affected first in the disease, and then it progresses further to affect the frontal lobe. So what we look for early on is problems with memory early on.
Very interesting. This is a fascinating conversation. How can patients find you if they're interested in having this kind of testing done?
There's two ways. One, someone can call our clinical assistant, Deborah Brew, at 464-2320.
Okay, there's, and we'll make sure we put that on our HealthLink On Air website so people can find it.
Thank you. And there's also a website people can go to, which is www.upstate.edu/npsychPMR.
Very good. And we'll make a link to that too. In general, though, if they want to see you, they don't just come to you directly, right? They need to be referred?
Yes. They need to be referred by a medical provider, typically primary care physician. Other people can make the referral, but it needs to be someone who's providing some type of health care to the person.
It does. And does insurance cover your testing?
Yes. Insurance generally does cover the evaluation. There are, of course, specific exceptions, but our administrative staff does try to go over that with people in advance so we could make a reasonable determination.
Very good. Well, Dr. Dominic Caron, thank you so much for coming by. This has been a fascinating conversation. I'm so glad you could join us this morning.
Thank you.
And listeners, we do need to take a break. Please do stay with us. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink On Air on 570 WSYR.